place, I'd like to share these recordings with you.
Welcome back to the Maintainer Podcast, the show where we highlight the people, projects, and stories that keep the fleet mission ready. I'm your host, Jared Patch, and before we roll into 2026, we're taking a look back at 2025. We're revisiting some incredible conversations and accomplishments from earlier this year that we wanted to make sure you, our listeners, didn't miss. We'll get an update from Marmax CEO, Captain Dan Heminger, get some tips from Marmax top marksman, Dylan Caves, and check in with the crew over at Floating Dry Dock Dynamic. We'll also revisit the early delivery of USS McFall and talk with a few of the talented technicians who supported our allies on the Poland flyaway team. Later on, local sports fans might hear a familiar voice, and you can learn how to get your black belt, no karate required. We've said it before, but it's worth repeating. Marmac is packed with talented, dedicated people doing remarkable work every single day. And this episode is an opportunity to celebrate many of those efforts all at once. So let's get started. You're listening to The Maintainer Podcast. To kick things off, we're joined by Marmac's commanding officer, Captain Dan Heminger, with an update on what's been happening across the command and what lies ahead.
Welcome back to The Maintainer. This is your CO, Captain Heminger. Thank you for joining us for our end-of-year episode. To say this year has been challenging would be an understatement. From DRP to the hiring freezes, from the longest government shutdown ever, to the ever-present demand signal for support from our fleets, you all have displayed an unwavering commitment to each other, to the mission of this command, and to our Navy. It's been a fast, demanding year across the waterfront, and I couldn't think of a better time to slow it down for a moment and recognize the incredible work done by the heavy hitters here at Marmac. Just to put things into perspective, in FY25, Marmac executed roughly 230,000 mission man days across our four mission pillars. That translates into over $1 billion worth of depot level maintenance, over 50 total ship readiness assessments, over 10,000 fleet tech assists, over 90 CMAVs, including over 5,000 eye level work requests, overhaul in excess of 125 pumps, executing over 40 maintenance assist team visits, executing over 4,500 dives, accumulating 5,000 hours of bottom time, that's most in the Navy, by the way, and awarding over 250 Navy enlisted classifications. Truly impressive. On top of what we plan to execute, Marmac continuously over-executes in critical mission pillars, and FY25 was no different. We over-executed in TISRA, Fleet Tech Assist, and eye-level maintenance, to the tune of over 13,000 man days. The so what is that based upon those numbers, we needed around 65 more folks that we didn't have. And guess what? Marmac still overachieved, and you all delivered increased readiness and lethality to our Navy fleet. As we close out the year, I want to pause and simply say thank you. The long days, the late nights, your sacrifices are making a difference each and every day. Throughout the holiday season, please be safe. And remember that you're a vital member of the world's finest RMC. Spend this time with friends and family to recoup and recharge your mental, physical, and spiritual batteries. Today's episode is a chance to come to all stop and reflect, to celebrate, and to hear from some of the folks who kept the fleet in an optimal state of readiness this year. We'll talk about our accomplishments, the lessons we learned, and we'll recognize the amazing people who make up this command. A lot more to come in the year ahead. CO out.
Thank you, Captain Heminger. We always appreciate your time, insight, and leadership. Earlier this year, public affairs specialist Oscar Pope had the chance to sit down with Marmac engineering technician Dylan Caves, who took second place at the 63rd annual Atlantic Fleet and All-Navy East Rifle Championship match, an incredible accomplishment that reflects discipline, focus, and a lot of practice. Dylan shares how he turned a failure into a championship win and how the supportive competitive shooting community helped him get there. We hear about the importance of proper gun safety and the role hobbies play in finding a better work-life balance. Here's Oscar's conversation with Dylan Caves.
You're listening to the Maintainer Podcast. And we have with us here today a gentleman who is definitely not afraid to pull the trigger on an opportunity to shine. He hails from Pagosa Springs, Colorado, served 6 years as duty as a Navy diver, 9 years in the reserves as a Navy diver. He's currently attached to NAVC Dive East, but drilling right here in Marmac. And the reason why he's here today, he's recently earned an impressive second place at the 63rd Annual Atlantic Fleet and All-Navy East Rifle and Pistol Championship Match, representing Marmac's code 286, Dylan Caves. Welcome to the show.
All right. Good morning, Oscar. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Feels like a second Monday, but I'm doing good.
Second Monday. I've never heard that one, but hey, I like it. So let's get right into it, right? We got a little bit of time. I wish we had more time, but we got a little bit of time.
We'll make it work.
Yeah, we'll make it work. So let's get to know you a little bit.
All right.
So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into shooting in the first place?
I failed. I was my previous reserve unit. I was attached to the Marines out in Hawaii, and I had to do a Marine rifle qualification, which is shot at 200, 300, and 500 yards, and I failed horribly. So they let me reshoot. I basically failed it again, and they said, ooh, better luck next time. And so I turned that failure. I reached out to a friend of mine that was on the marksmanship team, and he put me in touch with a guy here locally, a retired EOD commander, and he was kind of my mentor for the first year. And I went down to Moyock, North Carolina. We shoot there and at some just local ranges, local competitions. And the first couple matches, I borrowed some gear, borrowed some equipment. And apparently I learned a lot. So that was step one, was I wanted to learn how to shoot because I failed my Marine qualification. And apparently I turned out to be half decent at it once I figured out the basics. And so that 1 year mentorship turned into me, you know, building my own rifle and competing. And by a year and a half, 18 months in, I think I had won my first EIC Excellence in Competition badge, which was not normal. So that was it started as a failure and turned into something very positive.
So that's good. You know, you learn from your failure, which is an amazing accomplishment for anybody to learn from their failures. So at which specific point do you remember that you were like, all right, I'm pretty good?
So again, I was down in Moyock, North Carolina shooting, and it was guys that were much senior to me. They had many more years experience of shooting than I did. So it's only my fifth or sixth match, and an EIC point, they can only issue so many EIC points depending on the attendance. So if you only have 10 people, you can only issue one EIC badge. Okay. And so there was like 11 people there, and so they could only issue one. And I was just shooting. I didn't think I was in competition. It was just any other day. I was shooting with really good people. And I learned that day that A, you don't have to shoot your best match to win. Everybody else just has to shoot poorly. So I ended up winning my first bronze, EIC bronze medal. And that was when I kind of looked at the people around me. I was like, wow, I really like almost idolized some of these shooters. And I was like, these guys are impressive. And I can't believe I just outshot them at 200, 300 and 600 yards with a rifle that I built. I was like, okay, all right, what do EIC points mean? How does this work? And that's when I really got into like, all right, let's lock in. Let's do what we can to improve in all aspects. So
that's interesting. You won with a hand-built rifle.
Yep.
Homemade. I guess you could say homemade.
Yeah,
rifle.
Yeah, it was homemade. Yeah, I had some people help me with materials and parts and pieces and tools to build it. But for the most part, yeah, it was built by me and it works. So
yeah, that's impressive.
It was it was cool.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the experience, the match experience itself.
Okay.
And again, congratulations on, winning second place on this match. Tell us about what that experience was like.
So this was actually my third year up at All Navy. My first year there, I actually won the high new shooter, and I won second place for the reserves as well. And then this past year, I won second place for the reserves. And that was, it's not a simple feat. There are some really good shooters in the Navy, and so to do that is no small feat, but it is it takes a lot of work. I didn't train nearly as much as I did. I was traveling a lot for my civilian job this past winter, so I didn't really have time to do my dry fire, my training nearly as much as I would have liked. I missed a couple matches locally, so my preparation going into the All Navy was not where I wanted it to be. So in my eyes, I actually didn't shoot super great. I know I still took second place. I had some mechanical issues. I had a new barrel, so I had replaced the barrel on that rifle, and I was having some mechanical issues with the my equipment, which is...
You didn't have a muzzle brake on it, did you?
No. No. So we shoot service rifle. So it's okay. An AR-15, 20-inch barrel, 4.5-pound trigger, 4.5-power magnification optics. That's the category, the class of rifle that we shoot. And so that's shoot all the way back 2, 3, and 600, and actually back to 1,000 as well. That's in 223.
Yeah, but you talked about some of the tougher moments in this match. But what part of the match like really pushed you to do better?
Ooh, the marksmanship community is very close knit, but I've never seen such a competitive community that is also willing to share their little tidbits and secrets. And so I talked with a gunny sergeant Martinez. He's with the Marines. And he was like, hey, man, I see, you know, you had a pattern like this. Try this next time. And he just kind of gave me some pointers. And I was like, okay, there's another level. Like, I'm doing all right. But there's a whole nother step that I need to be at. And so he gave me some pointers. And that was really when I kind of locked in. I tried some different things with my positional shooting in the prone position. And it really helped in. So, like, I took that advice. And that back at the 600-yard line, you know, you have to read the wind. And reading the wind is no small feat, and I'm not great at it, but a lot of people got caught by the wind. It shifted left, right, and most people that were normally shooting 195 or above out of 200 were shooting like 185s, and I'm normally like a 185 to 190, but I took this advice, and I ended up shooting a 195. And so I did really well, and it was one of those key moments where I was like, okay, I am capable of progressing. Even though I shoot these scores, I absolutely can go higher and continue to excel. And so I know where I'm at, and I'm really happy with where I'm at in the short amount of time I've been doing this sport. But I look forward to continuing that learning curve,
right?
And learning more.
Absolutely. So you find your zone after you get this an amazing advice from a gunny sergeant.
Yep.
At that point, you're starting to crush these events.
Yeah.
So which specific event do you feel like you absolutely nailed it?
Ooh, that 600-yard line was a really good day. So we shoot like 7 days in a row. It's a 10-day. The all-Navy Atlantic Fleet matches are, I believe, 10 days. Three or four for pistol and then six or seven for rifle. I think I had some difficulties early on. The 300-yard line, so the 300-yard line course of fire is rapid-fire prone. So within 73 seconds, you have to shoot 10 shots at 300 yards. Again, that's a 3-inch X at 300 yards. I'm normally 95 or above, and I had turned my dial on the scope the wrong direction. It did not go well, and so I didn't do well at 300, and that really bothered me. I had a whole group that was all up high, and go ahead.
Yeah, no, you said 7 seconds?
73 seconds.
73 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, so a minute and 13 seconds.
Is that fast?
It depends on your mindset.
Okay.
So there are times when, like, if you don't do it, you have to do a reload in there. So usually you load a magazine of 2, a magazine of 8. You do your 2, you're like, okay, I feel good. You do your magazine of 8, and you continue your course of fire. Well, if you miss your reload or you have a jam or a malfunction, then your mind starts racing and you're like, oh no, I gotta go. And then you just go pop, 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 and you know,
right,
good luck.
Right.
Plan and preparation. You know, that's always the biggest thing for me is how you prepare. And so I didn't do well there.
Yeah.
But then I went back to 600-yard line and I had to like refocus, recenter, get my zen together, you know, your competitive mindset. And just I took my time. So at 600-yard lines, you have 20 minutes for 20 shots. So it's slow fire, prone. So you're laying down, you're comfortable, you're laying there, you're on the ground, you're on your mat, and you just take one round at a time and you shoot that. Boom. Okay, let's see how that went. Okay, cool. That was a good one. Let me see what I can do next. So you have a lot of time to really think and focus, hopefully not on your previous shot, but just on each individual shot. And that helps with your mindset to, just focus on the now. You know, just because if you pull, you know, a 5 or a 6, doesn't mean your next shot can't be an X or a 10. You know, if you can keep everything at X, 10, 9 ring, you know, you'll be doing all right. So,
yeah,
honing the mental focus from stage of fire from 300 to 600 is always it's a battle. You know, people internalize if they do poorly at 200, then they take that poorness to 300 and 600. So shifting and adjusting and understanding yourself is an important key factor in marksmanship.
Yeah. You're talking about when you were shooting at 600 yards,
mm-hmm.
you had to adjust the dial.
Yes.
So in terms of reliability, how reliable is it to tinker with your equipment during the match when you know you're against the time?
Yep. It's very reliable. The equipment that I have, I trust it. I rely on it. It's very good. And again, this is over the last three or four years. It depends on your shooting style. So like my first year, I didn't touch the knobs. I always turned it the wrong direction, messed up my scores even worse. I was like, ah, this is terrible. And then my first year at Inter Service, I saw the Army Marksmanship Unit, the AMU guys, which are like top, you know, those are the guys. Every single shot, they click, adjust their knobs and their scope. I'm like, man, these are the professionals doing that. All right, I got to learn how to do it. And I'd go do it and I turn it the wrong direction, or it just, you know, I do too much or too little. It never worked for me. So I use a little bit, people call it Kentucky windage, but I'll just use holdover. And as long as you know your target size and all that, you can kind of estimate, you can accurately acknowledge where your holdover is to maintain your scores. And so I'm trying to relearn the knobs and the wind and how to time everything. So it does take time, especially during a rapid fire, but I wouldn't be afraid to make an adjustment during a rapid fire stage.
So you mentioned something about a little bit of trouble you had.
Yep.
I mean, that goes into like your mindset and the pressure that you're feeling during this match. These matches could definitely be mind wrecking.
Oh yeah.
Under that pressure, how do you stay calm under this type of pressure?
Sing a song. No, I don't know. A couple different methods. You know, just you kind of have to let everything go. You have to, if you had a bad shot, you got to leave it in the past. You got to let it go. It happens. You know, nobody, even the Army, you know, they don't have perfect shots every time. But you just have to emotionally let go of that last shot. And I think so. Mindset is huge. It's as much a part of the sportsmanship of the sport as is, you know, your gear, equipment, and training. You know, your mindset is huge. So, yeah, it just takes training, you know. Things happen. A bad day on the range is still a good day.
Right.
So, you know, just happy to be there.
So, obviously, you're back in one piece.
Yes.
Right? So, that means you know a bit about gun safety.
little bit.
So, tell us, this is the important stuff, really, about the whole ordeal. You did phenomenal in the competition. But you couldn't be that way unless you were safe with that gun or that
rifle.
So talk to us about safety. What's a rule that most people forget about gun safety?
So the four gun rules are, you know, don't point your gun at anything you don't intend to destroy. Keep your finger straight and off the trigger until you're ready to fire. You treat every weapon as if it were loaded. And you need to know your target and what's behind your target. Those are briefed every single day. So I was the rifle director for the All-Navy rifle matches. We had about 120 competitors, and I had my RSO, my range safety officer. He did a safety brief every single morning. And even though all of us are experienced shooters, everybody heard the same safety brief every day. It's amazing that, you know, you have all these weapons are very expensive. These are all highly trained individuals, and not once was there ever a safety violation. It was, you know, just everybody's very safe about it. They have, they're called an empty chamber indicator. It's like a little flag that you stick inside the chamber. So you can just visually look at a firearm and know that there's nothing chambered in it. There's nobody behind the gun. There's no handling of it once you're on the fire line. You have very specific phases that you're allowed to do your preparation and your dry fire preparation. Now, things do happen. We did have, at a local match, we were in dry fire prep. So this was not live fire, but you're supposed to be in position. You're getting ready, getting your gear together. And somebody accidentally thought he heard go, and he sent one downrange. Not an issue. It was pointed in the right direction. It hit the target. It was very safe, but it was just out of time. Okay. So that was really the only thing. But not everybody here grew up with firearms, but everybody there at these competitions are very safety oriented. We understand that without safety, none of these events could happen. So it's impressive to see this level of skill and training and marksmanship, and safety is not once ever overlooked. A common phrase I like to use is nobody outranks safety. Doesn't matter if you're the captain of the marksmanship team or a third class that just showed up and has never been here before. Safety is ingrained into everybody, and everybody has a voice to speak up about safety, which is really great.
Absolutely. So talking about, you know, obviously we all work here at Marmac, and the motto is we fix ships.
Yes.
Like, what would you say to someone that says, hey, man, shooting rifles doesn't have anything about fixing ships? But, you know, my idea is this is a good work-life balance. I think, you know, obviously we talked about this, and you could agree, work-life balance honing in your skills off duty. Tell us more about how that relates to your performance here at Marmag.
Okay. It's a great stress reliever. It's a hobby. It keeps me sharp. I'm a huge fan of learning new things. And my 2 years here at Marmag as a civilian, I've learned a lot. And then so to have an outside hobby that you're also honing your skills, keeping your mind sharp, it helps me in all aspects of my life. Professionally, I'm learning new things every day. We just got moved up to a 286 code. I do all the sonar dome diving. And so that's, that was new for me. I was a Navy diver, but sonar dome diving was kind of out of my wheelhouse. I was normally outside the dome in the water inspecting it. Now I'm inside the dome doing the dry inspections, but while pressurized. And so it's a new skill set. And I think the marksmanship has really taught me I can learn anything. Anything can be trained or learned. And from a stress and quality of life, I talk a lot about quality of life with my coworkers. It's about the work-life balance, but quality of life is phenomenal. And the fact that I have the time to go do these matches and Marmag allows me to go do this for the reserves is phenomenal. And it's a small group of people up there that at their commands let them go and do and train. And it's a really great opportunity. And for any sailors that are or civilians that are looking to go do this, I highly recommend it. It's a really, really interesting sport. Like I touched on earlier, it's a competitive sport, but you're only against yourself and everybody's willing to help you. And it's a really great community. It's not just, gun toting people, we get a lot of people here from very different walks of life. And, everybody just wants to learn a new skill and it's really fun. It's very accomplishing. I brought my mom to a match one time last summer. She came down, never fired an AR rifle before. And, she came down and she shot at 600 yards, hit the target, oh my gosh. And, never done this before. So the equipment that we use and the skill and the safety, again, brand new person to firearms. And she loved it. So now she goes home and she shoots and does that. And
that's really cool.
She's a lot of fun. So we're all about, safety, quality of life and things like that.
Yeah. It's awesome that you're finding that balance and using that and both your personal and professional life.
Yeah.
So let's go to a rapid fire round.
All right. What do you got?
We got some. Yeah, I got maybe three rapid fire questions. I'll shoot at you here.
See what you did there.
First one. Your favorite shooting drill.
Like course of fire or like training
preparation drill.
Preparation.
I would say.
Okay. So I do a lot of dry fire in my house, and dry fire just means I'm sitting in my living room or standing in my living room because the first course of fire is at 200 yards. It's called offhand. So you're standing, and my rifle weighs 18 and a half pounds. It's a very heavy rifle, and so my wife will be sitting there watching TV, and I will just be sitting there in my jacket, and I'll have my rifle, which is clear, empty, and safe, pointed in a safe direction. And she'll be watching TV and I'll be there with hearing protection and everything on doing my dry fire practice. And we'll just be like hanging out together. Like that's so, she's like, it's weird, but I don't know. It's fun to, she's not super into the marksmanship world, but she gets a kick out of it. So dry fire is huge. Just offhand, that's my worst phase. So that's where I try to do the most practice at.
All right. Most underrated piece of gear.
Ooh, I got two.
Give me one.
Okay, this one, I didn't use it for the first 2 years. And then a buddy of mine was like, oh, you should try this. It's called a lens reducer.
Okay.
Okay, so if you look down your scope, you have like a 1 inch or 1.5 inch opening that you're looking through. Well, this lens reducer makes it to a pinhole. So you can only see your scope through this little tiny, less than a 1/4 inch diameter hole. And it just kind of helps with like sight alignment, sight picture, some of the basics of marksmanship. It's one of those things. I was like, nah, this is kind of a gimmick. Like it's just, you're just looking at the reticle. You're looking through the scope. And then I got one. I was like, oh, this is nice. I think I'm a big fan of it now that I use it. So lens reducer would probably be good.
Next one, your go-to pump up song before a match.
Listen, I'm like a hippie kid from Colorado, but I listen to a lot of techno and like house music. And I don't even know if I have I just got like a whole playlist on Spotify that is just like Lane 8 as an artist. I don't know. It's like soothing, but also like, I don't know, gets me going. It's a good time. So yeah.
Okay.
A little bit of different. Yeah. Different music.
Dylan, we appreciate you stopping by, speaking with us.
Yeah.
Definitely wish you well in future matches.
Thank you very much, Oscar. I appreciate it.
And, absolutely.
We'll see you around soon.
All right.
Big congratulations again to Dylan. We're proud to have you representing Marmac and the Navy.
I'm DC-1 Estriado. I'm part of AFDL-6 Dynamic of the Docking Department.
Good morning. I'm at AC-2 Robinson.
I'm Lieutenant Commander Jeremy Mayfield, Dynamic Commanding Officer. Second oldest floating vessel in the Navy.
Yeah.
81 years old.
That's old. That's a lot of maintenance and upkeep over the years.
Yeah.
Our next story takes us to Floating Dry Dock Dynamic, where the team executed an impressive cost savings evolution that helped the Navy save both time and money. Oscar had the chance to sit down and talk with the crew about how they planned this evolution, how they pulled it off, and what their innovative approach means for future operations. Over to you, Oscar.
So while we're here today, we got wind that you guys did an evolution that saved the Navy a ton of money. Correct me if I'm wrong, $124,000 savings.
Approximately $124,000.
Okay, yep. That's a lot of money.
So ACU-2 reached out to us. They had canceled the docking that we had on the schedule, so we didn't have anything scheduled. Typically, give ourselves about 10 days to get through block builds, pre-checks, markings of the craft. So they reached out on a Monday, and that gave us about 3 days to get our block build done and get everything set up to bring the craft in. And the team really, they knocked it out. They got the block build done. We got the craft marked. HG2 recently just built some new posts for our stern reference marker. In the past, we've been having to do it a different way where we set it up after the craft comes in. But with his ingenuity, we were able to have a permanent fixed marker, which makes it more accurate, more efficient, so we can get the vessel in.
Yeah, you talk about his ingenuity, Robinson. You're talking about
HG2 Robinson. That's correct.
That's quite a contribution to the event. So tell us a little bit more about your contribution and your ingenuity.
So the contributions I gave for this docking that came up was, as CEO pointed out, that I had to make the new post to basically what was going on is the craft couldn't go in because of the level of the anchoring chain. So we had to weld a new post on to make it higher. So now that the craft can go in.
You mean a chain link?
Yes, the anchor.
So the chain link for the listeners, like there's like this oval type.
So essentially the wing walls of the Dynamic, there are lifelines on it, just kind of like a ship, like steel fixed lifelines. And what AC2 is, he manufactured two posts. Typically what we've been having to do is we wouldn't set this up. And this is the most critical mark for when you're docking because you base everything off your stern reference point. What they did was they fixed posts and essentially lifted them 11 feet up. And what that does is when we're at 20 feet deep in the dock, now instead of having to set magnets up and worry about the accuracy of our markings, we have a permanent fixed point, which also saves time, right? Because every time you go down, divers are waiting on you, the craft's getting in, lines getting fixed and things like that. So anything to make the docking more efficient and more accurate makes it a safer overall evolution.
Okay. Estriado, am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's close enough.
How did you contribute to this evolution?
My contribution was I essentially led pretty much both of our entire departments in the build of all of our soft caps or towers. We have like 17 soft caps towers that we have to make sure sits perfectly or at least close enough to perfect underneath the LCU. So that way it doesn't tilt or lean, pitch, whatever. Our whole job was to make sure that every last soft cap was perfect so it does not shift at all while it's sitting.
Is this dunnage? Is this considered dunnage? Like the blocks that the ships sit on? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. Yeah. So there's two types of blocks. You got hard blocks and you've got soft cap.
I'm back in the old day military where we call that dunnage. You familiar with that term?
Yes.
So I'm with you. I'm following you.
That was pretty much my whole job. I was leading both departments essentially and building those new soft caps, measuring them out, making sure that they're good to go to be presented up the chain. And once they're presented up the chain and everything's good, signed off by our CO over here, we're essentially ready for our docking. That's my contribution.
Back to you, CO. What just makes this evolution special? What makes it different and stand out?
So in this case, typically we give ourselves a minimum of 10 days, right? And these guys were able to get the block build done, everything accurately in place, divers scheduled, right, on short notice to get the whole team working together to make the evolution happen. And by doing that, like we were able to get the vessel in. They found some extra problems, right, with their cork nozzles. So instead of having to go to a private shipyard being able to come to Dynamic doesn't cost, and like the craft is already paid for. So, you know, we estimate that on average, one day in a private dock is $5,000. So every day that a craft sits in a lay period in the dock, that's $5,000 a day that the Navy doesn't have to pay for.
Okay.
And it enabled ACU-2 to change two shafts, fix their cork nozzles so they had some cracks. The cork nozzle is the nozzle that actually goes around the prop and directs water flow in front of their rudders. So they were able to fix those so that there's no more water intrusion into them. They changed two shafts. They were 1,100 pounds each, and a couple of our guys got in there. To watch them crane everything, move this 1,100-pound shaft under, you know, a six-foot space up underneath a craft, it's pretty awesome to watch the teams work together. And they were able to get the shafts changed. They flushed the jack water system for their generators, both their generators and their main engines. And since they could come to the dock and we could get it done on a short notice and not go into a private shipyard, all of that was able to be accomplished by sailors.
Some people will say cost savings is not necessarily always a good thing, where you may skimp on quality. So how do you balance cost savings with the quality of service?
I mean, in this case, right, we were able to give them a time frame and meet their time to get the craft in and buy them the time and space instead of having to wait on contracting to get their craft in and then ultimately get it out so that they can meet the Atlantic Alliance to meet their mission.
And I think more importantly is that you have the expertise to do it at a reduced price. You got heavy hitters like Estriado and Robinson. I mean, you can't go wrong.
No, not at all. We are very lucky and really Dynamic, and I don't know if everybody knows this, we are the only active dry dock that is 100% operated by active duty personnel. There's no civilian involvement. I mean, these guys do everything from stem to stern, from the maintenance, the block builds. We have a carpenter shop. I mean, they do all this work themselves. So it's not like we're relying on somebody else to come out. They do the calculations. We make sure we know the vessel's weight. We make sure everything is accurate to execute the evolution safely and really just get the craft back on the water and operating.
Absolutely. Kudos to your accomplishments, sir, and your team. Marmac is truly blessed to have such a talented team of folks to get things done internally, in-house, as we call it. Who you want to shout out, Robinson?
I'm shout out the whole Dynamic.
The whole Dynamic.
The whole Dynamic. And I ain't just shout out, just too, it's going to be the whole Dynamic.
That's right. We all contribute. Well, not me, but you guys. Hey, thank you guys for being here. Until next time, until the next cost-saving evolution. Looking forward to hearing more success stories from you in the future. So keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thanks for the time.
You bet.
Bravo Zulu to Lieutenant Commander Mayfield and the entire Dynamic team. This serves as a great reminder that new ways of seeing and doing things can lead to real change. And when you're saving that much money, the change adds up. Next up, we pivot to the good ship USS McFall. Public Affairs Specialist Harrison Cox met with Project Manager Travis Dalton to talk about completing McFall's maintenance availability, resulting in the early delivery of the ship back to the fleet, an achievement that reflects the coordination, commitment, and expertise of so many departments across Marmac. Travis doesn't hesitate to share the win with everyone who helped make this maintenance story a success, and he urges others to tap into the deep knowledge base found here at Marmac.
But we're Marmac. We got 3,000 people that can help us. If I don't know the answer, don't be afraid to ask. Somebody in this building knows the answer. You just got to find them.
So without further ado, let's listen to Harrison's conversation with Travis Dalton.
Hello, everyone. My name is Harrison Cox, and I am here with our McFall project manager. How are you doing, sir?
How are you?
I'm good. So can you just give us a quick introduction about what you do here?
My name is Travis Dalton. I work in Code 300. I'm one of the project managers. I'm specifically assigned to the good ship McFall. I've been involved with it off and on since 2016. I oversee contracted ship maintenance on behalf of the captain. We are their on-site representative for everything that involves Marmac in the contractor's facility on a given ship, other than the contract side, which that'd be the Code 400 reps that we work with.
So it sounds like you have some experience doing that. Almost, what, 10 years?
I've been at Marmac since 2013. I started as a shipbuilding specialist. I became a lead shipbuilding specialist, an APM, and then I transitioned to project manager in 2020.
For those unfamiliar with naval maintenance, could you explain what an ISRA is? Because that's what the type of maintenance the McFall was in.
Yep.
And how does it differ from the other maintenance periods?
So the ISRA program started as part of Task Force Greyhound, is the understanding that I have. That's this whole Navy plan to try to get ships out of maintenance faster. you normally would have an SRA, selected restricted availability, and the I in ISRA is incremental selected availability, basically. They're usually a lot shorter. So instead of being the normal 120-ish days that we would get or more, 6 months typically, these are less than 100 days right now. ISRA one for us was 97 days. That was last year. And then this year's ISRA was 93 days.
And if I'm correct, we completed that 7 days early.
We did. So by, you know, the Navy has the NDE, Navy data environment, where they schedule everything and they give us an allotted amount of time to do the availability. Mm-hmm. And then we give a contractor a certain period of performance, usually a little bit less than what the NDE date is. And we did beat the NDE date. It was on time contractually for contractor period of performance, but mm-hmm. NDE date, we beat it by a week.
That's awesome. Okay. And what does finishing early on a project this complex really mean for the fleet as a whole?
It allows them to task the ship to do missions on behalf of the United States. It gets them into their training environment. As part of the task force Greyhound ships, they are more operational. So those shorter periods allows them to continue operating mm-hmm. instead of a normal ship that's going to come out of the shipyard and it's going to start training phases and basic phase and do all of their workups to get ready for deployment. When the ships come out of ISRA, they can go right on deployment if they needed to. McFall last year after ISRA was gone almost the entire year doing random missions that the force commander needed. So they were home very little.
Right. So it sounds like it was pretty important.
Very important for force generation, the way that I understand it. It allows the operational commanders the ability to go out and use that warship instead of it being stuck in the shipyard. So we really try to target what we want to fix to something we can get done inside of the period of performance, try to limit growth, try to limit new work, and really get the ship fixed and get her out doing what she's supposed to be doing.
For sure. And I know that, you know, the work being done was pretty complex. What were the major systems and components that required attention during this ISRA? And have there been any challenging repair jobs?
So like all DDGs, we spent a lot of time and effort on the uptakes and intakes. McFall fortunately has a really good port engineer who had a plan on what he wanted to do over the years. And my predecessor, the previous project manager, started implementing that plan. They split the ship kind of in two. And then they said, from this, we're going to work on these sections and we're going to try to focus on the things that always give us problems. Mm-hmm. So uptakes, intakes, getting the structure repairs done in the aft stack, getting exhaust inspection done so we can make sure we don't have any exhaust leaks, which we were very fortunate we didn't. Working through that stuff. And VCHT, I don't know if you're a sailor, VCHT is kind of super important for everybody for habitability. And on every DDG, it's always a struggle.
Definitely.
We put so much planning effort and so much actual physical work effort into repairing the aft system this time around. The last time I talked to DCC about it, about 3 weeks ago, he's like, this is the best it's ever worked. He's like, wow. All the effort that you guys put into trying to do this, working with us, he's like, it's paying off. He's like, this is great. So that felt really good for myself and the team because it was a headache.
For sure.
Sick of the least. And to get that stuff back up and running and have Ships Force tell us everything that you guys wanted to do made such a big difference, they're pumped. Because during deployment, they were replacing pumps constantly, having to fix pipe on their own, doing temporary repairs. We went in and we flushed the system. We put in new pumps in. We replaced an insane amount of pipe. And they're like, hey, it's doing what it's supposed to do, and we are able to sleep at night and not worry about it not working. You know, knock on wood, obviously. But it's in a way better shape, and that's a big win for us. Another really big win that we took is we had our forward CWIS mount replaced. We had NSWC come in. They pulled the gun out. They redid all the flanges and everything where all the seals go. Mm-hmm. It worked like clockwork. It was awesome. Great. But that was a huge win for us.
Well, yeah, that's all lovely to hear, you know, and it's true that the McFall was at East Coast Repair and Fabrication, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and how did the partnership with East Coast Repair and Fabrication enhance the capabilities during the availability?
So it worked out really well. We were very fortunate that ISRA 1 was awarded to them, and at the same time, they awarded ISRA 2. I had basically the exact same team, two availabilities in a row, 1 year apart.
Nice.
So we had already had that really strong foundation of, we know how they work, they know how we work, and it was a team. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we kind of have always carried on any team that I try to be a part of, is that we literally are a team. We're here to get the job done, and the same job is fix the ship and get it to sea. And they were 100% on board with that, and it was a really good experience. We were able to work together as a team. We got the ship done. We did find some stuff that we had to bring in as new work, and they handled it. They took care of it and met the schedule as we asked them to. So, I mean, it was a good experience.
That's good. Yeah. And we know that teamwork is really important, especially for shipbuilding and for different departments within Marmac. How did the coordination happen during a complex ISRA such as the McFalls?
I can tell you right now, I get to take credit for us winning, but it's really the folks at Marmac that are in all the other codes. The 300 folks that work with me, the shipbuilding specialists, they're really the start of that. Like, they jumped through hoops to make things happen, like going to all the checkpoints, doing the things. But I am very fortunate that we got to also carry over the same 200 folks that were supporting us. And I can't tell you how many people in 200 we give phone calls to, hey, can you come do this assessment, or can you come look at this? We're having this problem and we need you. And they showed up like it was nothing. Same thing for 900. We were having isolation issues on the ship. Ship's horse couldn't get some stuff isolated on seawater side. 900 divers came out and saved our bacon like 4 different times by installing plugs and stuff. The command really coalesced around helping us out. And I think that just is a testament to the way that we run our team. We're all a team. We're here to get it done. I need your help.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And working with the team, were there any new techniques, tools, or processes that the team implemented during the ISRA?
Not necessarily. I think the biggest thing is we just tried to over communicate, and we went in with a positive attitude, and we went in knowing that we're going to leave on time and we're going to make it happen. Right. How do we make that happen as a team?
Yeah. And you guys did.
And we did.
7 days early.
2 times in a row.
It's good to hear.
Yeah.
Okay. And for civilians that are considering careers in naval maintenance, what would you want them to know about this field?
I really like what I do. I don't think it's for everybody, but it's like anything. It's been really good to me, but I really like fixing ships. Like, it's really cool to see the ship leave. I think it's a very rewarding path. Mm-hmm. If you get into it and actually like it, it's an incredibly rewarding career. And you get to learn cool stuff that, you know, I'm just a nerd and I like learning the things that I learn about the ship. I'm like, oh, okay, I didn't know that before.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of opportunities to learn, and you're making a difference, like whether you know it or not. Working on the warship, you're really making a difference, particularly for the sailors. You know, they don't know everything, and we don't know everything, but we're Marmac. We got 3,000 people that can help us. If I don't know the answer, don't be afraid to ask. Somebody in this building knows the answer. You just got to find them.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I think that's one of the things in ship repair that kind of has always been a problem. Even when I was an apprentice at the Navy Yard, people are afraid to ask. Because they don't want to look stupid.
Right.
Nah, dog. I'm the first one to say I'm dumb. Let's go find somebody that can answer this question for me. And that's just kind of the way that I've always looked at it. And I try to tell, you know, newer SPSs that will get that they're coming from either the Navy or wherever. I'm like, you don't know everything. No one is ever going to know anything. Don't feel dumb asking a question. Just ask.
Yeah.
And it's just been kind of the way that I see it, and it works.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Well, Travis, thank you again for your time. I think we had some really awesome answers here for the McFall and the ISRA. Again, congratulations to you and your team for completing the ISRA 7 days early.
Definitely.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
McFall deployed from Naval Station Norfolk in November, and we offer our deepest appreciation and best wishes to the sailors as they carry out their mission. Outstanding work done by the entire McFall team. Congratulations on a major accomplishment.
Welcome to the Maintainer Podcast.
If you've been to a Norfolk Tides or Norfolk Admirals game lately, you might recognize the voice of our very own Brian Gimble, who serves as the PA announcer for several local sports teams. A few months ago, Brian joined us in the studio to talk about his role at Marmac, how he got into announcing, and how the voice behind the mic differs from the voice you might hear around the office.
When I get into the stadium,
the personality changes. Leading off the top of the first for the Tides, the first baseman, Dylan Bieber. In goal for the Admirals.
Whatever. It's totally different stuff.
Here's Oscar's conversation with Brian Gimble.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So today we want to highlight Marmac's talent outside of fixing ships. And we got wind of, you doing some pretty cool things on your off time. But before we get into those things, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Colorado Springs, Colorado, the foot of Pikes Peak, home of the Air Force Academy, Denver Broncos fan growing up. And then when the Rockies and the Avalanche came into being, then I jumped on their bandwagon too.
Rockies baseball?
Rockies baseball. And that's all we're going to talk about there. They're not having a good season at all.
Okay.
They're setting all the wrong records.
So would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
That depends on the setting.
Okay.
It really does. To be behind the microphone and all ears focused on what you're doing, you have to be willing to put yourself out there a little bit. So in that regard, I consider myself extroverted.
Okay.
If I'm in a big room full of people, particularly people that I've only meeting for the first time, I'm very introverted. I'm going to sit back and watch what's going on.
Right.
But I get into the box or the press box and get behind the microphone. I got the script in front of me and you feel the energy in the building, then definitely extroverted.
Yep. Looking on a glass door, places like that, when you put in some of the things that, you know, your personality type, it gives you public address announcer mm-hmm. is one of those as being suitable for an extrovert.
Right.
So that kind of checks out.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. So let's switch over to your career. Mm-hmm. So, you know, reason why we're here today. So tell us a little bit about what you do here at Marmag.
So I am in code 224. We're an integrated test engineer is the title. We manage the work certification of the availabilities. We track the quality OQE, the objective quality evidence that the shipyards, the LMA, are required to produce and submit, and the project managers are required to answer. And we track all of that upcoming up to key events to make sure that the contract is meeting certain wickets, certain milestones, and that the work that the LMA and other people were contracted to do was done in accordance with the technical standards and is ready for the ship to move on to the next phase of the avail, be that testing, be that going to sea, being that coming off a dry dock. We track all of that stuff.
So definitely a key point when it comes to getting the ships out on time. They have to pass the tests.
That's the plan.
Right. And how long you've been here, Marmat?
I've been here 14 years.
That's a long time.
That's a long time.
In which avail are you currently working again?
I'm currently finishing up a very short EM emergency avail on the Gravely, and I am also the ITE for the Tortuga modernization, CMAVs, and then those availabilities, trying to get her back to sea.
And the Gravely, how are they doing?
Gravely's fine. Gravely's getting ready to get underway in the next few days, and my avail on her will be done, ready to support her getting out to sea.
Cool. So tracking green.
Yep. Very
awesome.
Much so.
We love to hear ships tracking green, getting out on time,
mm-hmm.
and you play an integral part as an integrated test engineer to make that happen.
Which we try to.
We much appreciate it. So now, on to your alter ego.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're not posing as an integrated test engineer, tell us about what it's like being a public address announcer.
So being the public address announcer at the events that I work at, you get there early enough, your building's quiet, nothing's going on, and you go through your preparation to get ready for the game. But as the fans start rolling in and you start interacting with people, the energy comes up. That brings my energy up. And then when I sit down to the microphone to do that, welcome to insert venue here, then all of the fans start getting more and more excited. You bring that energy level up. And then when the game actually starts, I'm a fan of that sport first, watching it from that perspective, with the best seat in the house. You know, I'm not going to lie, it's pretty cool.
Right.
So you're sitting there, you're watching the game as a fan, but you have to pay attention to what's going on so that I can tell you, honestly, so I can tell you what you've already seen with your own eyes.
That's right.
But it adds something to the event. I like to try to think I'm adding something to the event to increase the energy level and just make it for a great atmosphere for the fans and for the players.
You know, that's an important part of it, you know, bringing that energy, you're feeding off the fans' energy. It's like you're that piece of the puzzle or that piece of the whole evolution or the whole game. It's like, okay, what energy do we bring into to the game?
Mm-hmm.
And the fans are dependent on you, your level of energy.
Well, they're depending on the athletes on the field or the ice or the court first. If that product is lackluster, then it makes my job that much harder. And I've been in those venues where the team is getting completely waxed and I still have to bring up the energy and try to bring it.
And that sounds pretty difficult.
It's challenging. You just have to put yourself in your own head and say, this is what I'm here to do, and I do it. The flip side, when there's something really great happening out on the playing surface and the players are excited and the fans are excited about what's there, then that just makes my job that much easier.
So what's your favorite part about the job?
One, getting into sports for free. Okay, not going to lie, that's really cool. But bringing that energy, being part of the experience for both the athletes and the fans, being a part of what they're there to experience. I take some pride in knowing that they're coming and they're going to enjoy what they hear, what they see, and all that.
So let's take it back into time. Like, what prompted you to be or want to be a public service announcer? Where did you realize, oh, I've got the voice?
I did not realize I had the voice for several years after I started. So it goes back to almost 20 years ago now, believe it or not. My daughter was in middle school, and for one of her academic programs, she needed public service hours. So she started volunteering for a women's semi-pro or amateur soccer team out in Virginia Beach, the Piranhas. And we got involved and got to know the owners and started doing things in the press box. And when their public address announcer, who also happened to be Green Run Football's announcer, when he stepped away, my wife, who was working now in the soccer team's front office, said, hey, let's put him on. Let's put him on. Let's see what he can do. I said, okay, we'll try it. So I did. And everybody said, hey, you sound great. You're doing a great job. I said, okay, you're my wife. You're my friend. You're the owner of the team who have become friends with. You're not going to lie to me. So your opinion doesn't matter. So I did that for 2 years. My son started playing junior hockey at Chilled Ponds for the Whalers. They needed a guy. So I said, hey, I've been doing it out here. I enjoy hockey. I'm going to be here anyway. Give me a shot. So I did that. And people in the building that I'd never met before, didn't know, have any idea who they were, said, you're doing a great job. This is your niche. You need to keep doing it. And it just blossomed from there.
You, I guess, replaced an announcer that announced for Harbor Park at one point in time.
Yes. For 30 years.
For 30 years. Yes. That's what I read. Was there a turnover there?
There was no turnover per se. Jack Ankerson is that guy's name, and he still currently does Old Dominion football and basketball. And when I started, after I got doing that thing for the Whalers, for the junior Whalers, I went back to the guy I mentioned before who worked for Green Run. And I said, hey, how do I get into a high school job? How can I get in to them? And he told me, you just reach out to the athletic people there and ask and whatever. So I ended up at Kempsville High School. Then I ended up at Princess Anne High School. I said, I'm going to reach out to Jack and I just want to pick his brain, see if he'll talk to me about PA things, with the goal in mind of being his backup. When he had a schedule conflict, when he had an illness or whatever, say, hey, Jack, I want to be the guy that the Tides call to fill in for you when they have to. So he came to hear me do a Princess Anne basketball game. It happened to be against Kellam, which is where his grandson played. One of the first things I do at every game, I get with the visiting team to get the pronunciations of their players, the challenging pronunciations. After the basketball game, the head coach of Kellam basketball went to Jack and said in all the years he'd been coaching, nobody had ever done that. And it impressed him. That impressed Jack. Jack heard my voice at the basketball game. He said, yes. He went to the Tides and said, this is the guy I want backing me up. That went for about 6 years. I did a week's worth of games when he was doing the Portsmouth Invitational basketball event in early April. Some other things when he had stuff for his grandkids, I would fill in for that. Fast forward to 2 seasons ago, the beginning of last season in April, the Tides called and said, hey, Jack is stepping away. Do you want it? Well, yeah, that was the goal all along.
Absolutely.
Of course.
That's what you prepared for.
Right. So April of last year, I came on full-time as the Tides guy. Jack just wanted to step away to spend his summers with his active grandkids. He's still doing Old Dominion football and basketball. I've filled in for him at Old Dominion basketball games a handful of times. So I'm still on his radar.
Right. Having done your due diligence, it definitely paid off.
It did.
I mentioned in the beginning the Norfolk Tides and the Norfolk Admirals, mm-hmm. but you do public announce for other sports teams.
I do Norfolk State football and basketball, both of which I owe to Jack Ankerson, because Norfolk State reached out to him for women's basketball and said, hey, do you know a guy? Well, yes, I do. And they called me. That morphed into men's basketball and football when the guy who was doing those at the time passed away. So I just slid into those two spots. I also do Old Dominion volleyball. Again, I owe that to Jack Ankerson because they called him. He already worked for them, like I said, for football and basketball. They needed somebody for wrestling. So he said, yes, call this guy. So I did wrestling for 3 years, I think, until that program folded. Well, the following year, volleyball started. Happened to be the COVID year, so we had to wait a period of time. So now I'm doing Old Dominion volleyball. And Cox High School baseball, I got through my wife having a friend's mom on the team, and so I got that. So those are all of the teams that I'm working for, and I owe most of it to Jack.
So public address announcer, is it similar to a commentator?
No.
So you're not commentating games, okay.
Completely unrelated. The commentator, the guy you hear on the TV or the radio, the play-by-play guy does exactly that. You know, quarterback drops back, pass to whatever, and then the commentator, the analyst, will tell you why that happened or why that was bad, why that was good, or look for this the next time. That's the guys that you're hearing on radio and TV. To hear me, other than very faintly in the background on TV, you got to be in the building. Like I said before, all I'm doing is telling you what you already saw with your own eyes, that the pass was complete to this person, the ball got advanced to this yard line, was tackled by that person. Well, no kidding. I just watched it.
Right.
But somewhere back in history, somebody started doing this and it added to it, and now it's become a thing. So yay me.
Right.
But no, not a commentator. My job is not play-by-play or telling you that was a good thing or a bad thing.
So the most exciting game you've ever announced?
The most exciting game, there's been a bunch of them. But anytime a significant moment gets called out, I go all the way back to my Princess Anne High School football time. Princess Anne High School football, for those that don't know, was awful for a very, very, very long time. I started doing them. And they got a new coaching staff in, and they had a pretty good year. And they were looking at getting into the postseason for the first time in forever. We had a game that came down to overtimes. The final play, this one final play, Princess Anne runs the ball into the end zone, but it's in a scrum of bodies right up to the goal line. Can't tell from outside, did he get in, did he not? And so we're all waiting here on pins and needles. If he gets in, game over. Princess Anne moves on into the next round of playoffs or into the playoffs. We're waiting, and we're waiting, and the officials are huddled over here talking. And, of course, fans are yelling at him, make a call, he's in, he's not in, whatever. It was a full 5 minutes of waiting for these guys to make a decision with no video replay. It was just these guys talking for 5 minutes. And then finally the arms go up in the air, touchdown, Princess Anne wins. So it was just pandemonium after that.
Probably the longest 5 minutes.
It was awful. It was awful.
So how did you fill that void, that space of waiting?
I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. The band played.
Wow.
You know, Fabulous Marching Cavaliers, they played their music. We take a break. People would talk. I mean, there's nothing for me to say. Again, I'm not a commentator.
Right.
I can't make an analysis. Did he get in? Did he not get in? You know, hey, the officials are having a really hard time getting this. It's not my thing. So we just have to sit and wait, twiddle our thumbs, band plays a little bit. We sit and twiddle our thumbs a little bit more. And then, like I said, finally the arms go in the air and pandemonium.
It's awesome to have you here on the show today and getting to learn a little bit more about your alter ego as a public address announcer, not a commentator.
Not a commentator.
Thanks for clarifying that difference again. We look forward to hearing you again in the future. Tell the folks where they can find you on social media and where can we hear you next?
Well, I have a Instagram page. It's Brian Gimble Voice. There's not a whole lot of what I do PA announcing that's on there because, you know, I'm an old man. I don't know how social media works, but I have a page. I'm trying to make it better. But if you want to hear what I do, check the schedule for the Tides, the Admirals, Norfolk State football, Michael Vick, head coach Michael Vick at Norfolk State football, expecting packed stands for that. So check those schedules for Old Dominion volleyball, Norfolk State football, basketball. Come hear what I do, and if nothing else, come support your local pro and college athletes.
Thanks, Brian, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
The Norfolk Admirals are currently playing a series against the Reading Royals, so you can hear Brian in action and support your local team by getting out to a home game. Brian, thanks for giving us a peek behind the microphone. Next, we're highlighting an extraordinary story of teamwork, diplomacy, and global impact. Earlier this year, members of Marmek traveled to Poland as part of a flyaway team supporting maintenance on two Polish Navy frigates. They represented Marmek, NAVC, and the U.S. Navy with professionalism and skill, and left a strong impression on our allies. Oscar sat down with two members of that team to talk about their mission, the challenges they faced, and what it meant to collaborate with our partners overseas. Take it away, Oscar.
Hey, joining me here today is Gas Turbine Systems Technicians Mechanics, a GSM-1 Ha and GSM-2 Garcia. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
So let's start with your background. Garcia, we'll start with you. Where are you from, man?
I'm from El Paso, Texas.
Okay. And how are you from?
Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Portland, Oregon. You're quite a ways away from Virginia here. So yep. When did you join the Navy, Garcia?
I came in 2017.
2017. What about you, huh?
Same.
Same 2017?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So got a first class here, second class here, first class running the deck plates. Whether you're LPO or not, you still, you know, had a huge hand in this evolution. So we'll get into that. Any hobbies you're into, huh?
No, I've just been trying to finish my college degree.
Okay, what's that degree in?
Master in Business Administration.
Oh, nice. You plan on using that when you transit out of the military?
Yeah.
Okay, making that money.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, what about you, Garcia?
I like to go to the gym a lot, and then I also like to build race cars on the side.
Definitely can see you in the gym. Big swole over here. You know, our listeners can't see you, but this guy is pretty buff.
I'm all right.
Modesty gets you everywhere. All right. Hey, look, we'll get right into it. So for the listeners that who may not know, the GSM rating stands for Gas Turbine Systems Technician, and in this case, mechanical. Its specific rating within the Navy's enlisted classification system focuses on the maintenance and operation of the mechanical components of the gas turbine engines and other related systems. So this includes maintaining, operating, and repairing the engines themselves, as well as associated machinery like gears, shafts, and propellers of sorts, right? So why are we here? So the Polish Navy was in a situation where they needed some, you know, significant engine replacements on two of their frigates of their what they call the flotilla, what we call a squadron, right? So that name flotilla has kind of evolved because the ships have gotten larger. So they'll call them flotilla because they use the frigates and we use squadron. But they had two of them that needed engine repair replacements, both fast guided missile frigates. We're now over there fixing them after selling to them some years ago. We're now over repairing their engines. So tell us about how that all went down. So we know you got the call to assist. Where do we start?
Pretty much the oversea representative for the U.S. got the message from them for engine replacements that was required. He sent the message back here. I believe our tech code, Dave Cook up in Philadelphia, messaged us here. And then they sent a group of three civilians out to Poland. And then they also requested additional 8 personnel from Marmek. And we got sent up out there.
Okay, so a total of 11 personnel?
Yes.
11 personnel, eight sailors. And three civilians. So how do they pick you? Like, what qualifications do you have to say, hey, we're gonna send this guy or this girl?
Mostly just like kind of a volunteer opportunity, but they also chose people they were confident with in getting the job done in a timely manner.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. So this is called the flyaway team.
Yeah,
right. So flyaway team consists of how many total are on the flyaway team?
It just depends on the size of the job needed or like the type of job.
Okay.
Because sometimes we'll fly over to Rota, Spain and assist with them out there. Before, they didn't used to have a turbine shop out there. So it used to be like, it was called GTMAT, and it was basically training the boats out there. That would be like a team of three.
Okay.
And then it could go from like a team of three to a team of eight to a team of 12.
So the size of the job kind of determines how many people you send.
Yeah.
Or the complexity of the job.
Yeah.
So what was your hand in it? You know, what wrenches were you turning?
Well, I mean, it required a lot of support, also like from the ship as well. But like for Poland, they didn't have the capability. They didn't have any training on like an engine changeout. So we have to be involved in pretty much every part of it, from the intake all the way to the exhaust. We are also pretty grateful for having Techco support in it as well. The civilian guy out there, Paris, he's a port engineer out there, and he was also helping us with the language barrier as well.
Wow, so he was a translator for you guys?
Yes.
Wow, so how was that? How did you guys fare with the translation efforts?
It was pretty easy because some of them actually did speak English. It wasn't too hard of a language barrier, but there was times where it was hard to translate as to what stuff was needed, like a garbage bag. They didn't understand what garbage bag was, and we had to like grab one and show them.
Right. So as far as like the repair portion of it, getting down there replacing parts, were they more hands on, or were we more hands on?
We have a few like ship personnel that were very involved during the evolution. They were very motivated to learn, and they were actually like helping us out. Another difficulty we have is we didn't have enough tools. We have fly out there with the Pelican case with the tools that we think we need.
Right.
But then the tools out there in metrics, so we were also struggling with that as well.
So that's crazy. You go out with a Pelican case, you know, anticipating, yeah, we're gonna fix this ship, and then we are under the standard measurement, and they have metric measurements. So the conversion is like a little challenging.
Yeah.
Wow. But you muscled through it. And that brings us to, okay, the next evolution that we have overseas where it deals with metric systems. How are you now prepared?
It's one of those learning parts that on our end. So next trip, we'll have one like that. We would take both sides, metric and standard, just in case. We can't go out in town and find the right size of tool, or that way we're not scavenging all over for one.
Right. So these are little things that, you know, happen behind the scenes that not a lot of people know go on, but all they hear is the success of the evolution. But you guys are putting in a lot of effort, a lot of dedication to making things work. But you got the job done. So congratulations nonetheless. You got kudos and accolades, a letter of appreciation from the Polish Navy. They want to thank you for the swift and effective change out of the engines. Seamless execution is what they're calling it. So I want to, you know, first congratulate GSM-2 Garcia and GSM-1 Ha on your participation in this evolution. I know there were many that you know, contributed to this, but they sent the experts here to talk about what the evolution today. Anybody you want to shout out? Any codes you want to shout out? Any people you want to shout out?
The rest of the team, the GSM-1 Morbel, GSM-1 Juarez, GSM-1 Ballesteros, GSM-1 Devro, and GSM-3 Doering, and GSM-C Henderson.
Nice. If you guys are listening, shouts out to you. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Oscar mentioned the letter of appreciation sent by a rear admiral in the Polish Navy, and I wanted to share a little bit more of that letter, which read in part, I would like to express my heartfelt thanks and appreciation to the team of technicians from your department. Their exceptional contribution and professionalism enabled us to achieve full operational capacity and readiness. It was indeed their hard work, commitment, and precision that were crucial to the successful completion of this project. We, the Polish Navy, appreciate the efforts of your team. And to the entire team, job well done. You make Marmac and the U.S. Navy proud. Our final feature today highlights a major milestone for professional development. Earlier this year, 25 new Lean Six Sigma black belts completed their training under the supervision of training specialist Tracy Edwards. Oscar spoke with Tracy about what the program means for Marmac, how it benefits careers across the Navy and beyond, and how continuous improvement helps drive mission success. Let's take a listen.
I'm here with a trainer extraordinaire, Tracy Edwards.
Good
Tracy,
on.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
I hear you're doing big things. You just recently had a graduation for the Black Belt, course for Lean Six Sigma.
We had 25 people graduate. We had Marmac, Mudsu 2, and the USS Bougainville.
Yep, and we'll get to all those details later. But first, tell us about you. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Franklin, Virginia. My father owns his own construction company, so I grew up down in that area with my father running his own business. I say, I used to work retail. I started out at Roses, worked my way up to assistant manager. Then I left there, went to Dollar General, became a store manager, became a district manager. And then I ended up leaving Dollar General, making more money, going to Advance Auto Parts as a store manager. And then I got tired of the retail world, got burnt out. So then I came to Marmac as a contractor working for Code 900 to be the continuity for the military. We were originally Norfolk Naval Shipyard. Then we left there, went to NISA, and then we went to Marmac. So then I got hired on as civil service in 2014, and I've been doing Lean Six Sigma since 2018, and I was the training coordinator for all of Code 900. Now I currently just do Code 970 divers.
Nice. Thanks for sharing that. So a Virginia native.
Yes.
You've been in the managerial scene for many years.
Yes.
And now you're gracing Marmac with your subject matter expertise and training us in different variants of professionalism and leadership by way of the Lean Six Sigma course that you've been doing since 2018. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know what Lean Six Sigma is, how would you explain to the listeners?
Lean Six Sigma is a methodology to improve processes, to eliminate defects, bottlenecks, and constraints in a process to make it flow more smoothly. So Lean came from Toyota production, and they first started Lean with Toyota, and then from there, Six Sigma came from Motorola in the 1980s. And with both of them working together, it makes your process more efficient. You eliminate all the constraints, and you're able to meet the customer's expectations by delivering a quality product and the time expectation that the customers like it.
Right, so big industry is using Lean Six Sigma.
Yes.
Right. So
Lean Six Sigma started from Japan. When you take the Lean Six Sigma classes, you'll hear a lot of Japanese terms because it did originate from Japan.
You, let's talk about you and how you've progressed through Lean Six Sigma qualifications or is it certifications. Take us to your process and how you've got your black belt.
So I started out at Norfolk Naval Shipyard. I took my classes from over there. I got my green belt. 2 months later, I went ahead and did my black belt, which was consisted of 200 hours of instructional time. I had to do a command project, which averages out anywhere from 150 to 200 hours. And then you have to take a final exam in order to get your certificate of completion with black belt, which is at least it's 4 hours and it was 75 questions. Once I completed that, you have to get certified ASQ. So you have to go to the ASQ website and take a black belt ASQ exam. With that, I studied for about 2 months, and that's 150 questions, and you have 4 hours to take that. So once I get my black belt certification through ASQ, I get certified as a black belt. Then in order to teach, I can start teaching green and yellow, but I can't teach black belt until I become a master black belt. So a master black belt, I had to have 10 projects underneath my realm, and plus I had to have 2,000 hours of mentoring, as well as have 25 people underneath my belt that I've mentored and helped do command projects. Once I completed that, I could take the ASQ certification for a master black belt, which that was 200 questions. I want to say like 10 essays, and I have 4 hours to take that. So I took that exam, and I got my master black belt.
So that is that the normal progression to achieve the black belt certification? Can someone jump in at any belt at any time to get their qualification?
Yellow belt is just an introductory level. It gives you a general knowledge of what Lean Six Sigma is. You can go straight to green belt if you would like. You can take your green belt class, which is 40 hours. We do that over at CEP 200. It's a 40-hour instructor time where we do a rapid improvement event with Statapult simulation. From there, once you finish that, you have to complete 2 rapid improvement events for your command, and then you're able to take the ASQ certification. You don't have to take the ASQ certification in order to go to black belt, but you have got to complete green belt with a certificate. Then you go to black belt, which we do that here. It's 1 week a month. It's 200 hours of instructional time, plus you have to do a command project. Most people do 2 command projects when they do their black belt class because of you have to have 2 command projects in order to take the ASQ exam. So most of my groups did 2 command projects this year, or some of them did 3. Once you complete that, then I have a 75-question test for you that you have to take. And once you pass that, you get a certificate of completion, which we just had a graduation on June the 11th with 25 people. I do have several people that are going to go get their ASQ exam for black belt. So we're taking like a month off, and then I'm going to start study groups with them. They're going to let me know what exactly they need more help with. A lot of people say statistics they need help with. They just don't understand it. Some of them are talking about hypothesis testing. So I will get with all them, and we're going to sit down and do study groups. I did have Lieutenant Commander Davis that retired from here last year. He took the black belt exam and called me up that night, and he had completed it and passed it. So you do know right then whether or not you pass it or not. You can go into a testing website to do it, or either you can go do it locally on site. Most people choose to do it at home.
Right. So you're able, or you're accessible while the students are preparing to take their testing. You're accessible to them around the clock.
Yes, I can, but I cannot be with them when they take the test.
Right.
So I'm accessible to them at any time. Just like with the projects that we did. We completed 13 command projects between Marmac, Mudsu 2, and USS Bougainville. With that, I worked outside of class. I figured it up. I pulled like 297 hours. Additionally, from what I do, working with these groups to make sure their projects were right and they were ready to present to their project sponsors.
That's a lot of hours.
Yes.
That, you know, it's a true testament to your commitment to your craft and leadership. Is it safe to say once you finish your black belt certification in the industry, would you be considered a change agent?
Yes. And also, too, you don't have to take the ASQ exam to go out and get a job. As long as you have your documentation, I tell everybody, build your portfolio. So once you complete each project, no matter who works on that project, whether it's a yellow belt or green belt, they get a copy so they can build that portfolio. Because when you go out to these local jobs here and submit your resume, you can say, I complete this many projects, but they're going to want to see documentations with it. So you turn in your documentation and so they can see it. Just like I had last year, two guys that were getting out of the Navy, they completed black belt projects in the black belt class. They had already got jobs before they completed the class. For when they got out of the Navy.
Right. So you're talking about they got jobs as change agents in the
yes.
organization. So give us a little bit of understanding about what a change agent is in light of what black belt, yellow belt, and green belt.
So a change agent will be anybody that's going into any industry, depending on what you're interested in, where they go in and they show you how to improve your processes, make it more efficient. They look for any kind of bottlenecks in the process, a lot of redundancy at work. We all get set in our own mindset, well, this is the way it's going to be done. We don't like change. But you go in there with an open mind and see if we can make the processes any better. And you bring the people that are working in that process on board, because everybody's got to be feeling like they have a stake in the process or have a stake in their what's going to change, because you got to be willing to change everybody's mindset. And if I tell you how do you think the process will be better, you're participating in making the process better, you're going to be more willing to accept change.
That's right. And in leadership, change is never easy.
Right.
But necessary nonetheless.
Yes.
So again, big kudos and congratulations on your accomplishments from way back when COVID tried to shut you down.
Yep, when COVID tried to shut us down back in 2020.
Yep, so we're back and you're back in full force doing an awesome job with Lean Six Sigma. You just recently had how many? You had a graduation in June 11th. So how many total graduations have you had the black belt graduation?
We've had six.
Six black
yes,
belt graduations.
Yes, and we've had 137 people graduate black belt.
That's it.
That's 2018.
That's impressive. So if I wanted to do a Lean Six Sigma black belt, do I need to work on my roundhouse kick?
Nope. You don't need to work on your roundhouse kick. I'll show you how to do that in class.
Thank you, Tracy Edwards, for sitting with us today on the Maintainer Podcast.
Thank y'all.
Congratulations to all the graduates, and thank you, Tracy, for all you do to strengthen this program. And that is a wrap on another episode and another year of the Maintainer Podcast. To everyone at Marmac, we wish you a restful and relaxing end of the year and a prosperous new year ahead. Thanks to each of you listening out there. We've seen our audience grow, and we're committed to continuing to improve this show and bring you the best stories from across the waterfront. We'll be back next year with more in-depth interviews, more spotlight stories, and more insights into the team who delivers mission readiness to the fleet the leaders in ship repair, the entire Marmac family. Before we go, we asked a few shipmates to help us sign off.
This is HTFN Chi.
This is ICSA Sanchez.
This is HTFN Scott.
Oh.
The Maintainer podcast is produced by Marmac Public Affairs.
Follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center.
You can also check out the Marmac News and Events page on SharePoint
to stay current with everything happening around the command.
If you have an idea for a future episode,
or your team is doing something that the command needs to hear about,
drop us a line at Public Affairs.
We'd love to hear from you.
We'd love to hear from you.
Until next year, fair winds and following seas. I'm Jared Patch, and this has been the Maintainer Podcast.
Pass complete to number 7. Gain of 12, down to the 30-yard line.
How was that?
That was great.